There's a reason Campbell's has been the soup authority for generations. And with Campbell's Culinary Reserve, they're also your low-fit passport to global flavors. With more than 60 chef-inspired varieties, Campbell's Culinary Reserve gives you scratch-made quality and on-trend flavors that scale with your operation. From standalone stars to versatile menu builders, discover how Campbell's Culinary Reserve can transform your menu at campbellsfoodservice.com.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Extra Serving, a podcast from Nation's Restaurant News. I'm Sam Okus, editor-in-chief of NRN, joined by my, I'd say, relatively suntanned executive editor, Alicia Kelso. You're welcome.
Sun-kissed, yes.
You're sun-kissed.
Yes. Yep.
Back from the beach, back from spring break. We survived without you, but please don't ever do that again. I'm with it. How was your week?
It's not like I wasn't paying attention, Sam. There was certainly a lot going on to keep me on my toes.
And your byline did pop up at least once.
It did. It's okay. Yeah, it's right. I hope somebody edited me because I did have a few margaritas. but yes, we had spring break with the family. Louisville does it like a week later than the whole country. So I think last week you and I talked on Extra Serving. The news was a little bit slow. It seemed like everybody was on spring break. And then, you know, this week, there was a significant floodgates opened, and I was just on a beach with a margarita.
The universe knew you were gone.
And we had talked about all that. This is going to happen when I'm out. I know this is going to happen when I'm out, but it is what it is. But we went to Clearwater, Florida, which is, you know, it's a lovely place to be. We don't typically do beach vacations. We typically do adventurous vacations like New Mexico last year and so forth. But Sam, do you know what Clearwater is known for?
I have a guess based on your sweatshirt. You're going to tell us.
Purely coincidental, right? I swear to you.
What a week to do this.
So the original Hooters opened and is still very much operating in Clearwater. So obviously there was some Hooters news this week. While I was out, and what a better opportunity to bring my family, including my 10-year-old son, to Hooters, the original one that was founded in 1983. Got some video, going to make a little original Hooters TikTok later, which is something I never thought I would say at this age. but the timing, Sam, the timing, it was really interesting. And, you know, we're going to talk about this, but I do want to point out this is owned by a different company. You know, the whole Hooters ecosystem is very complex. And these were the original franchisors or franchisees. And I think there's a couple dozen of them that still operate those original locations in Florida, including the one that we went to. Slight differences in the menu. Server uniforms were slightly different. I would say that a little more conservative. Mm. There's a retail store. A lot of history outlined on the wall. And we went on a Tuesday at 11 a.m. right when it opened, and it was packed.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Hooters, it's interesting because when you come across these stories, just to be clear, of course, for those living under a rock, Hooters filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy earlier this week, this week being probably a week after everybody's listening to this. But it's funny because when common folk, when just normal lay people hear company filed for bankruptcy, they think that means, you know, oh, they disappear. They shut down and they're gone. But of course, that's not true. Bankruptcy is about restructuring your debt. It's about, you know, being able to survive as a business. This is an option available to you. It doesn't necessarily mean that you just are suddenly closed up shop and you're gone. So for even the fact that, you know, Hooters filed for bankruptcy, but still is, you know, has a location that is packed, demonstrates that. And, you know, I posted this on LinkedIn, but I was quoted in an Atlantic article, actually, thanks to you, Alicia, because you passed that along, and was quoted in an Atlantic article about Hooters. And the headline was "The End of Hooters." And I pointed this out on LinkedIn that, you know, brand, you cannot kill brands, especially one that's been around for 40 years. You know, there are some examples, as we have talked about, for example, of Chi-Chi's. There are various things that, you know, a brand can slowly fall out of the sky and crash and disappear. Yes. But when you have something like Hooters that is for some people beloved and for some people still the place they turn to for wings and, you know, hanging out with their friends or whatever it might be, that affinity can keep the brand alive through the worst things like filing for bankruptcy. So it's always important to note in times like this that this isn't the end of Hooters. That's, you know, pretty sensational headline. But I would argue it is certainly not, you know, certainly not a good time for Hooters. And I'm curious to see what they do going forward, because out of this bankruptcy filing, we find out that basically the original founders, who are franchisees of that location, you point out, Alicia, they are now going to be essentially taking over. It's going to be an all franchised brand now. And the original owners are going to be kind of in charge of the direction from here. What, in your opinion, do you think Hooters has to do now, using that brand affinity it has? What do they have to do to get this brand back to any kind of relevance?
That's a good question. And I think everybody is trying to figure this out right now. They've got to get that debt down. I think the big issue here, in their bankruptcy filing, they cited, of course, inflationary pressure, industry headwinds. We could have a full conversation at a different time about the state of casual dining. If you're not Texas Roadhouse or a Darden brand or Chili's, you know, the state of casual dining right now is really grim. Hooters falls within that parameter. But their debt, I mean, I think there's about $370 million that we're talking about. But to our point earlier, the franchisees that are acquiring big chunk of these locations they have half of the highest volume Hooters in the entire system and operate about 30% of them. They're dexterous operators. And moving to sort of an asset light format under the leadership of those dexterous operators, I think is a really, really good start. It's a good direction. And, you know, I think that it should ideally simplify things. For the company, I think it'll take some time to get it back on track. There are some opinions that the whole concept of the restaurant, it might be a little dated. I don't have an opinion either way on that, because we know Twin Peaks does okay. Bombshells, however, has closed a lot of locations. There's a few folks on my LinkedIn who have opined that political correctness killed Hooters. I disagree with that. I think it was really interesting. I'm glad I got the opportunity to visit this particular Hooters, because I was talking to the servers and the general manager there, and there is a difference in the menu at these locations. And I thought the food was good. And, you know, I think... going to another Hooters, you know, that there were a lot of us have talked in our newsroom Slack that Hooters needed a menu revamp. That is what seemed dated, not the concept as much as maybe the food. Maybe it's all one thing, but I think that moving over to pure franchise system is going to, I think, help it. I do think that there needs to be a little bit more paring down. But well, you know, time will tell. I mean, we'll see. But again, this is, I think the bigger picture is the most important piece here. This comes on the heels of bankruptcies from Bar Louie, On the Border, of course, last year, Red Lobster, TGI Fridays, Buca di Beppo, et cetera. Casual dining is in a precarious position right now. And I don't know where the end game is there.
Yeah. And by the way, as we'll get to later in this conversation, we do have a treasure trove of some fresh data, which is that our friends and colleagues over at Technomic have updated their Ignite data for 2024 performance. So we do have some insight into how everybody did do. And just to be clear, Hooters 2024 sales down 16%. Now, Twin Peaks, though, I just took a peek just to, you know, take a look and see how it did. 5.4% up, which for all intents and purposes could be flat traffic because of inflation. But still, I think just kind of circling back around to a point you made, Alicia, around, is this the end of the restaurant? You know, this was something else that came up in this Atlantic piece that I was quoted in, and we had the conversation with this journalist, which was, you know, is it because we've moved past, you know, have we moved past this, you know, kind of time when you can put women in these clothes And guys, I got to say, I do not think that we have. And in fact, if anything, we may be kind of going kind of back to where that's even more embraced. And that, I'm not trying to make any kind of political commentary here. I'm just trying to say, like, there will always be a niche for whom I think that's fine. And that may be okay. However, I did say in to this journalist, I don't know if I made it in the story, but my belief is for some of these restaurants that in order to survive as a full service restaurant, I do think to some degree, you've got to make yourself more mainstream. I think you have to make yourself more accessible, because it's one thing to pick a lane that is, you know, kind of extremely like male oriented, you know, and a certain type of male who's looking for that experience. And you can work that to some degree. But I think for a national chain, especially one that is really flailing right now, I question whether leaning into it is going to be the answer for Hooters going forward, as opposed to, and what I think there's been some rumblings around, is trying to reposition to have that family, you know, customer be able to come in. Because, of course, we touched on this last week. I think we were talking about Bar Louie, and we talked a little bit about Hooters last week, Alicia. But I would not ever, no offense, I would not take my kids to Hooters. And I have no problem with you taking your son to Hooters, by the way. That's no judgment on you. That's just my
family. It sounds like it is.
Sorry, I'm not trying to judge you. But mostly that's because my wife wouldn't want us to take our kids to Hooters. And so now Twin Peaks, a little bit of a different story, because I think like it's a little bit of a different experience. But I guess the point is like to even have to have this conversation of wouldn't I, you know, shows part of the problem, because it's like it's not in the consideration set for a big chunk of America. And I think in order to succeed in this day and age, you know, to some degree, you have to have a little bit more widespread appeal. So I think then going back to your point on casual dining, which we're going to be unpacking for the next several weeks and months as we really dig into this data we have from Technomic, you know, I'm with you that I think that we maybe haven't seen the bottom for some of these brands. We will probably see a number of more bankruptcies this year from full service brands in particular. And it's because the economic climate, the fact that there are a lot of these concepts. And I think, as I described it in that article with Hooters, to some degree, it's sort of like if you're at a generic bar and grill concept, you know, you really need to find, you need to find a way to stand out, because there just became so many of those. I don't, you know, at the end of the day, again, Hooters will survive. And who knows, maybe it pulls a Chili's and 5 years from now, we're like, Hooters is the hottest brand in America.
Maybe.
but yes, it's going to be interesting to see what they decide as their path forward, because I think they're going to have a lot of decisions as to how to retool this brand to make it last longer into the future. Okay. Before I move on, I have to take a sip of this, and I wanted to point it out. First off, the glass you very kindly gave me, but yes. What is inside it, Alicia, is Seven Brew Sweet and Salty, which is white chocolate and salted caramel. If you go follow, by the way, go follow me and Alicia both on TikTok. This is the point. Since you brought up TikTok, I will say Alicia and I are now rookies.
Very much so. I've got a
how to do a TikTok, but I did a little thing with Seven Brew yesterday. That will be coming up on my feed hopefully in the next few days. But I got a bunch of Seven Brew that I couldn't drink, of course, all at once, or I would kill myself. So I saved the sweet and salty for today. So I'm going to take my sip, because this is very delightful.
You know, Seven Brew is my Friday morning vice. There's one on my way home from swim practice, and I stop every Friday morning. It's like I crave it now. And I get real excited. I'm like, I'm going to go get my medium brunette on ice. And there's three in a 5 mile radius. Well, we'll talk about this later.
Yeah, because there's a very big reason.
I'm totally jumping a gun here. Sorry, I've been on vacation. I forgot how this works.
there's no model here, Alicia. What are you talking about? We have no format. All right, well, let us move on to the other big news of the week, which was, and this is where your byline did show up. You couldn't cut the story, Alicia, which is that Yum! Brand CEO David Gibbs announced that he would be retiring in 2026. Of course, Yum! Brand's biggest restaurant company in the world. And David Gibbs started in January of 2020, which I distinctly remembered when, even before I read your story, Alicia, because I remember when the pandemic started thinking, oh, that poor guy who just took that job. Like, whoa. And they also had
Greg Creed was premonitious. He's like, peace.
Yeah, right. Exactly. They had also just acquired Habit Burger, like literally weeks before.
Weeks.
And so David Gibbs comes into the situation. Now, mind you, he was like a 30-year veteran of Yum! Brands. It's not like he didn't know what he was doing. But he comes into this leadership position, acquiring a chain and into the biggest global pandemic in 100 years. And I would say on balance, here we are 5 years later, talking about how David Gibbs is going to be retiring. I think he did a pretty good job. Now, Yum! Is not perfect. And we've talked at length about Pizza Hut and KFC. But Alicia, tell me your impression of the work that David Gibbs has done.
KFC US, to be clear. KFC Global is doing just very fine. Thank you very much. So, you know, I think the story here, of course, we're going to unpack Gibbs's, you know, legacy. Fortunately, we've got about a year to do that. But this is going to be one of the most coveted jobs in the industry, to your point. It's the biggest restaurant company. I think this will be, you know, it'll be really interesting to see who backfills David Gibbs because, you know, think about the succession plan. David Novak was a giant in the industry. Greg Creed, everybody knows Greg Creed. Everybody has a Greg Creed story. I was at Zaxby's headquarters 2 weeks ago, and they were talking about Greg Creed. And, you know, and I think that David Gibbs, you know, has his own legacy, which is different than his two predecessors. Those were marketing guys. Gibbs is a finance guy. So I think that will be a really interesting come a year from now to see what that succession looks like. The board is working on that succession plan now. But to your point, on his watch, you know, not only did they navigate the pandemic, I mean, Yum! Was a huge winner in the pandemic. They won one or two down quarters because they were so insulated with their off-premises heavy and franchise heavy model. They also, I think his big legacy in retrospect will be the acquisition of various technology solutions like Dragontail and TikTok, which have since been rolled in into the company's new, what it calls Byte by Yum! Platform to drive more of those digital transactions. I think Yum! Is over, you know, now north of 50% of all sales being digital. It just surpassed $30 billion in digital sales. I think that's going to be the big takeaway from his, you know, when we write his legacy story. There's also, of course, the new unit development, and that's more of a global story. I don't want to get deep in the weeds on the struggles of KFC US, even though it's personal to me, you know, because I live in Louisville. Or even
if his relevance to Louisville,
nothing anymore.
They're not there anymore.
too soon. But the pace of annual net new unit growth under David Gibbs has tripled. I think they were opening a new unit like every hour. They had some weird statistic. They're like, holy cow, you know. And they now have more than 61,000 locations in more than 155 countries throughout the world. They're north of, they're pushing $70 billion in sales. And this is compared to when he came on board, where they had about $52 billion. So, you know, I think we'll be talking about that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, this is not an easy job. But what's so remarkable about Yum! Is when you look at the family tree of Yum! And you look outside yes. of Yum! For all of the leaders at companies, you know, Julie Fels-Massino at Cracker Barrel, Kevin Hochman at Chili's, Liz Williams at El Pollo Loco, a few that we've talked about recently. But you can go on and on to all these other companies that the leadership at Yum! Brands, the leadership development is very, very strong, which is partly to say, to your point, like the succession plan here is going to be fascinating. I have more thoughts on that in just a second. But also just the point that like, the support for a CEO in a company like this with other very strong leaders is clear because it's like when you have so many other great leaders who then spin off into becoming CEOs of their own other brands, you know, you can see how much this company is set up for success with its leadership. So, which is not to take away from David Gibbs, but mostly just to say how impressive this system is and that when you get somebody like David Gibbs in that job, who, by the way, you know, not as flashy as Greg Creed. Greg Creed was is a personality, and I think was a lot of fun as the CEO because
he's a marketing guy,
exactly. And you're right that David Gibbs more the finance guy, more buttoned up. But lucky for them, they needed that in that moment. I think coming into COVID, especially now. to turn our attention to succession plan, because I think to some degree, perhaps the finance guy or woman, man or woman, will be needed still, right? Like, depending on who knows where we're at a year from now when David Gibbs actually does retire. But I think, you know, if you look at other brands right now, like a Jack in the Box, which just made Lance Tucker the permanent CEO, you know, you see other companies that are like, where once they may have gone with the marketing person, now they're going to go with the finance person because, wow, we've got to really tighten up the ship here to get through this season of inflation and tariffs. But I think I have three names for you. I'm going to throw out. Let's just see what you think, because I'm sure you might agree on these three names. My expectation for who they go to: Sean Tresvant, Taco Bell's CEO, Tracy Skeans, whose official title is?
She's COO and CPO.
Yeah. So, which would, of course, be also great for optics to have the first woman as Yum! Brands CEO. But Kevin Hochman, who has done a remarkable job at Chili's and, of course, came previously from KFC. What do you think about those three? Do you have any other names you'd throw out there?
I would think that they would consider Chris Turner, who's sharp and has really spearheaded a lot of these acquisitions and digital transformation of the entire company. And then I wouldn't, you know, if we're talking in a lot of those, if we're talking internally, Scott Mezvinsky is really super impressive. He's moved around a lot because they need him in various places, but I don't know if they would move him over there so quickly after taking the global KFC job. I haven't really had the opportunity to think about it, but those are probably the ones that I would also throw into the hat at this point. Now, if they were to look outside of Yum, you know, that conversation opens up a whole lot because we've got a lot of talent that isn't, you know, I think Yum is Yum and we'll probably prioritize Yum, you know, people because of the deep bench that it touts so much. And in fact, one of the things that we didn't talk about with Gibbs on his watch, and I think is really underrated, we talk about all these sexy bells and whistles, tech acquisitions, and of course, Habit Burger acquisition in 2020. Yum also bought HeartStyles in 2020, which is a development program that it's, mid managers and senior leaders go through. And that really has cultivated a even deeper bench than the company already had. And so, yeah, I don't know. I think I'm going to have to think a little bit more. I don't disagree with your three, but I think we talk about Chris Turner as well, especially.
Yeah. All pure speculation, of course. But that's where I would put the money on Tracy Skeans, just because she's been kind of next to David Gibbs this whole time, you know, and again, a phenomenal leader, very smart person. And not that they need the optics, but I don't know. I think it's about time that, you know, the biggest restaurant company in the world has a woman as CEO, but neither here nor there. Okay, let's briefly touch on probably the biggest global news of the week, even if it's hard to really know what to say for this from a restaurant perspective yet, which is tariffs. As we speak, Alicia, I believe all of our 401ks are disappearing.
Don't ever fire me. I'll be working until I'm 103.
Stock market in free fall. Of course, I will always caveat, you do not turn to us for a politics opinion, so we won't hear that. But we will talk briefly about President Trump's tariffs, which this week was Liberation Day, so-called, as he said, and institute tariffs on everybody. You get a tariff. Everybody gets a tariff. And the market has not responded kindly. Other nations have responded with their own, imposing their own tariffs on the United States. It's hard, again, to know what to make of this on the long-term basis. But I think we've been talking about tariffs now for months. And there was always a will they, won't they, in the sense of, is this actually going to happen? Well, here we go. It happened. And there's going to be a very clear impact on the restaurant industry. What do you think that impact will be, Alicia?
Gosh, I think that there is a concern. I think the initial concern is over cost of goods, food, equipment, construction materials, all of that. I think the bigger impact will be on consumer on the consumer. I really think that we operators have to worry about their P&L and brace for impact there and try and diversify their supply chain, which is a hell of a lot easier said than done. You know, not everybody has that ability, like Chipotle, to go elsewhere. But I think consumer sentiment is going to be the biggest thing here, because at the end of the day, they are predicting that these tariffs could add up to $7,000 in costs for the average American household. And that is just such a huge chunk of money, especially for the lower income households, which we've been talking about for over a year now, pulling back significantly from discretionary spending at the restaurant, you know, at restaurants. Restaurants, I think, are going to probably have to take some pricing again, you know, and gosh, oof, that we're just not in a position to do that. We've already taken about 30% pricing, which is why there's been a pullback here. So I'm mostly concerned about smaller and independent chains who just don't have the wherewithal, the resources, infrastructure, and pricing, you know, elasticity to deal with taking extra costs. So the volatility is going to threaten businesses and jobs. And, you know, I think that the consumer sentiment is where I'm going to be spending most of my time and attention watching, because when the consumer sentiment drops, that's when the you-know-what hits the fan. But I also think that there are some, the big guys are going to, I think, be okay. We saw that the stocks that were okay, you know, during the big drop-off this week after that those tariffs were announced. I mean, McDonald's was up. Yum Brands was up. And, you know, you and I, like we talk about all the time, we started in this industry during the Great Recession. The forecast for recession ticked up significantly with those tariffs. And those quick service players were insulated then. And the prediction, judging by the market, is that they will be. Again, of course, they've got the franchise model that sort of protects them a little bit. They, you know, if you think about McDonald's, they do a lot of domestic sourcing, which was a problem in October, but won't be a problem now. Yeah. You know, so I think there's going to be a lot of intertwined complexities. You know, if we could get into packaging equipment, all of that stuff, especially, you know, that's going to impact operators. But I'm going to be watching consumer sentiment, because we're already kind of, you know, in the gutter with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's most experts seem to believe this will issue us into perhaps a recession. You know, the National Restaurant Association, with the first kind of suggestion of tariffs a couple months ago, had written a letter to the administration saying this would cost the restaurant industry about $12 billion. I suspect that number will be higher now, because here's the thing, too, is you look at a company like Chipotle, which has been in the news a little bit lately for the avocado, for the sake of their avocados, because they've been set up as this example that is trying to work around the tariffs, in that Mexico supplies the United States 90% of its avocados. So Chipotle was very naturally buying a lot of avocados from Mexico, and that they are now actively changing up their supply chain. They now buy the majority of California's avocado supply. That's the most, obviously, by a lot, avocados coming out of the United States. But they were, you know, shifting their supply chain around to find different sources. Now, again, we find out that everybody's getting tariffs, right? This isn't a Mexico gets the tariff, and so you can go buy your avocados from Peru, because the issue here for the operator is supply chain. You have to find out how to buy the most affordable goods for your business. And in many, many instances, particularly with certain ingredients, that is an international source. So if you're going to reconfigure your supply chain because of the tariffs making those goods more expensive, you know, no longer can you just go find a different country that supplies that, because everybody's getting these tariffs. And unfortunately, outside of California, avocados don't grow very well in the United States. They need a certain climate. And so that's where this is particularly tough for the industry, which is in an industry such as this that is so wonderfully vibrant and serving so many wonderfully global diverse foods, the United States agriculturally is only able to grow some of them. And you will have to source other ingredients. And this is such a complicated thing. It's way over my head in a lot of ways. But if you look at, for example, as a comparison, the auto industry, which it's one thing to put a tariff on a foreign made car, but even the domestic car companies source foreign products for those cars. So you can't just say, we're going to slap a tariff and then, you know, anything coming in, because it's like that Chipotle bowl is many different countries represented in the bowl. Yeah. And you can get cheese from the United States pretty easily. You can get protein from the United States pretty easily, but you cannot get avocados very easily from the United States. Even California, which has a wonderful avocado industry that I have toured multiple times, and they're great. Only so big, only so many avocados. By the way, avocados, a lot of water goes into avocado.
Yeah.
So much that goes into this. So that's where we will be having to watch this going forward. You're right, Alicia. I think this is going to definitely push. It's going to force everybody's hand to take price, because there's no way, with inflation being what it has been, with labor as it is, with so many other costs and pressures, there's no way that you can just snap your fingers, fix your supply chain to do all domestic product and move on with your day. You're going to be impacted by this one way or another.
Yeah, you talk a lot about avocados. Let's not forget coffee.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I think there's something I'm going to keep an eye on too, that I think hasn't really manifested quite yet, but I think I'm bracing for a little bit of impact perhaps on the next round of earnings calls. And that's, I've seen a couple of international reports about boycotts of American companies overseas. And, you know, consumers in Europe are retaliating against the McDonald's and the KFCs of the world because of this. And I think that could be an interesting narrative as well. We saw that sort of with the, you know, with the Palestinian, you know, situation last year, that it did have an impact on Yum and Starbucks. So I'm wondering if that manifests as well. Again, there's a lot of stuff that's going into this global trade war that is at a scale that hasn't been seen in over 100 years. And I think that the restaurant industry is in the crosshairs, you know, and I think it's going to be a big concern moving forward.
Yes, it will be one more interesting layer to 2025 that we'll be talking about. Okay,
you know, restaurants haven't been through enough.
Yeah, the last 5 years haven't been enough for everybody. So let's add one more thing to our list. Okay, let's move to a little bit more of some heartening topic, which is the data we were referencing earlier from our friends and colleagues over at Technomic. Technomic updated their 2024 Ignite data, and we have been swimming around in that data now for a couple of days. And for our extra serving portion of this episode, we are going to be joined by our colleague, senior food and beverage editor, Brett Thorne. Brett, welcome to Extra Serving.
Thanks for having me. Nice to see both of you. Hi, audience. How you doing?
We just got done talking about tariffs, Brett. So we're going to try to steer things into a more optimistic subject matter. And that is the data that we received from Technomic on performance data from the major chains in America. And there's a lot of interesting tidbits you can pull from this data. And we will be doing that for the next year until we get 2025 data, really. But certainly for the next coming weeks and months, follow along at nrn.com, because we'll be presenting that. And then, of course, culminating in June with our top 500 report. But Brett, what jumped out to you? What's the biggest kind of piece of information you pulled from this?
That people like experiential dining, with things like Cooper Talk doing really well, opening a bunch of new restaurants, some other chains like that are into experiences, opened a bunch of units like Nobu and Kura Sushi. And also, you know, the chains that we knew were doing well are doing really well, like Chipotle, Leapfrog, Subway, and Burger King. Have you guys talked about this already?
Not on this episode.
Okay, no. Good. Popeyes also jumped over Pizza Hut and Sonic. Raising Cane's, I think, jumped from 18th or 28th place to 18th place, which is nuts. And Wingstop from 32nd place to 24th. So, whoa. I knew, and like, I cover Shake Shack closely. It's one of the chains who's, you know, quarterly earnings I have to report on. I didn't know how well they did. Their sales are up 15.5%. And Qdoba, who, you know, I'd kind of forgotten about, their sales are up by 10.4%. And they opened their unit growth count went up by 4%. So, which, and Culver's also did quite well, which I didn't know Culver's was doing quite well. So
if there's anything you pull from some of those brands too, Brett, I feel like there is a comfort factor for some of these, right? When you think about a Raising Cane's doing very well, a Wingstop, a Culver's, it's chicken and burgers. You know, it kind of makes me think of the COVID days when it was like, you know, the comfort food was what was driving decisions. It's a little harder though to make any definitive declaration on, you know, this category is doing great. I mean, chicken, it is fairly easy because, to your point, Raising Cane's, Wingstop, Dave's Hot Chicken, once again, just absolutely crushing it. But harder to say definitively over certain categories or another. Brett, you mentioned experiences. What other trends are jumping out at you from this data?
I mean, drive-through coffee, obviously, insane. Also, the Korean bakery segment. They opened a bunch of locations. Tous Les Jours and Paris Baguette opened a ton of restaurants. And Cava is on a complete tear. Their sales are up 33.1%. They opened 18.8% new growth. It's a lot.
I got to tell you guys, I went to Paris Baguette for the first time a couple of weeks ago. It opened here near my house. And it's lovely. There's a real DIY aspect to Paris Baguette that I didn't know about. And it was interesting because Katie and I went to visit Kira Sushi for the first time. And it and Paris Baguette opened next to each other, kind of fitting. It just feels like those are two solid Asian brands. Kira Sushi, of course, very DIY. What do you call those things? The belt of sushi that's going by you. Conveyor belt. There is the word I'm looking for. Conveyor belt of sushi. And then go to Paris Baguette, and it is, you know, kind of fill your own treats into your bags. And Brett, what I'm getting at with all that is it goes back to, I think, to what you're talking about experience, that there is, this is not your average walk up to a counter place in order, give you your food, sit down, eat. It feels like those really hot brands today, even to the drive-through coffee, there's a little bit more of an experience to it.
When people kind of taking control of their destiny and managing their orders, obviously, the drive-through coffee, everybody wants to customize their stuff and then post it on social media and have it be multicolors and all of that.
Who would post to social media about drive-through coffee, Brett? I just don't know who would do that.
Yeah, weird. I don't have any bosses to do that at all.
I got to tell this story too, though. I did mention earlier, I went through 7 Brew yesterday. I'm going to do some social coverage on it. That's the joke. I pull up and, Alicia knows this well, cause she's been, Brett, have you been through a 7 Brew or a Dutch Bros or any of them yet?
Living in New York City, I don't go through drive-thrus.
You don't get the drive-thru experience. That's true. So 7 Brew. So, you know, hospitality, they all kind of rave about how hospitality is a differentiator. So I pull up under the little roof. I place my order with the remote order taker, and then I pull up under the roof to where the guy's running the food out. And he says, Disney, Nickelodeon, or Cartoon Network? And I'm like, excuse me? And he points to, on the glass window, they have a running tally of customers voting. Do they prefer Disney, Nickelodeon, or Cartoon Network? Which was so not what I was expecting, but led to a very hearty discussion on why Disney is the best. From my perspective, he was really Team Cartoon Network. But like, where do you get those kinds of experiences? And that for 7 Brew, that's very intentional. I mean, they're very much like, we want to make their day, not just through this good beverage. We want to do it through the interaction as well.
When years ago, I would go to places, not drive-thrus, but little takeout places that would have a little tip jar, but except they'd have two tip jars. And you got to make a choice between whatever, Marvel or DC or whatever it might be. And so that's a fun experience, but also you're tipping. So, you know, and this was before everybody got insane with tipping. This is pre-COVID that this was going on. And I thought it was such a smart way to engage with your customers and also get bigger tips.
Yeah, exactly. That's very much the experiential part of it. Okay, Alicia, I know you've got lots of opinions. And again, we'll be unpacking them, so you don't got to dump them all out at once. But give us some of your top level.
I don't get paid for opinions. I wasn't surprised that Chipotle leapfrogged Burger King and Subway. I think there's a sleeper in Panda Express. I think last year we talked about that a little bit. They're squarely in the top, I think, what, 15 now. They jumped Panera. Yeah. The big narrative is Texas Roadhouse is a new casual dining darling. It jumped Olive Garden and Applebee's. And, you know, I cover their earnings, so I'm not surprised. But I think it's a big deal nonetheless. They're significantly younger than those two brands and significantly smaller. I was bummed about KFC. you know, the chicken category is going this way and KFC is kind of going that way. But Raising Cane's, like, to Brett's point, just on fire. I was really surprised that the sharp slowdown from the prior year's growth. I knew 2024 was a challenge, but, you know, the top 1500, they grew 3% on an annual basis from 7% in 2023. I didn't realize that the industry had slowed that much, and that kind of shocked me. But to everybody's point here, to tidy it up, and I am not surprised because we talked about it earlier, Sam, that Seven Brew, I've got 3 in a 5-mile radius now of my house. It's my Friday vice. It's now your vice, I see.
Yep.
They jumped to 108 from 208 last year and hit triple digit sales growth for the third straight year. Every time I pass one of the ones by my house, it is busy. And we're getting ready to open a Dutch Brews in between two of those. So that's going to be really interesting. But we talk about Starbucks and Starbucks challenges and blah, 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 and what, you know, how it got too transactional. But I would argue it's these up and coming specialization drive-through convenience driven concepts that are probably eroding Starbucks more than the Starbucks experience becoming too transactional.
Well, and Starbucks also is now like the punching bag of many consumers. People are mad at them for a wide variety of reasons. It reminds me of what McDonald's was for like the generation before. Anytime somebody was pissed off at something, they'd blame McDonald's. They talked about McJobs and anything that happened, obesity, whatever it was McDonald's fault. And now it's Starbucks' fault. And that's an interesting shift.
Definitely interesting perspective. And I should say, you know, a lot of this feels like inside baseball because we've all been doing this for decades and this is all fascinating for us. But for anybody in the industry or anybody who's a consumer, it's also important to note the reason why this is so fascinating is because of how much it is a barometer of where things are going. So it's fascinating because, like, again, perspective, Starbucks, $31 billion in sales last year. Dutch Bros about $2 billion in sales last year, and Seven Brew about $500 million in sales last year. But 10 years ago, Seven Brew did not exist. Nobody was talking about Dutch Bros. It's just, you know, again, kind of barometer of where things are going. It's fascinating to watch which brands kind of seize the narrative and the attention, not just of the industry, but of the consumer. So I think, you know, that's where we find, you know, we're kind of read the tea leaves in all of this. And again, we will be doing that for a long time to come. Okay, we need to jump. Brett Thorne, Senior Food and Beverage Editor, Alicia Kelso, Executive Editor. Thanks as always.
Thanks for having.
Great to see everybody.
Hey everybody, Sam here. It's April, which means that Nation's Restaurant News is getting ready to publish our annual Power List, which explores the concept of power among leaders in the restaurant industry. This year's focus is women in food service. And as a preview to the list, which drops this week at nrn.com, I'm excited to share this excerpt from an interview that Brett did with three powerhouse leaders from Shake Shack: Chief Financial Officer Katie Fogarty, Chief Growth Officer Steph So, and Chief Operating Officer Stephanie Sintel. Enjoy the conversation.
What is it about Shake Shack's corporate culture that the three of you like? If you do, if you don't like it, you can tell me that too.
maybe I'll start as the newest in, and I guess maybe what attracted me to Shake Shack, having met the team and had an opportunity to meet each of the members of the executive team, I actually walked away wondering if it was too good to be true. I was like, this is just the interview process. Everything is great. And the reality is, it really is true. And I believe it is because the company actually walks the walk and doesn't just talk the talk as it relates to being a people first company. And that starts with the team members in our restaurants and really expands into our support centers. We have had just record retention numbers while also building a company, which isn't always the easiest thing to do in parallel. And, you know, the people first approach and the opportunities, I've always felt this about the food service business in general. Somebody can start anywhere within this industry, different than many other industries, and go just about anywhere. And I truly believe that anyone in our restaurants can sit in one of our seats one day if they truly want to and are willing to work to get there. And you just see that in the fabric of this company, the way we treat each other, the way we work together, and candidly, just the way we show up for one another, whether it's new restaurant openings or, you know, team members working through something, whatever it is, it still is too good to be true on a lot of days that I am here. But having an opportunity to lead our restaurant teams and 20,000 team members, it is just amazing to see the actual culture and the way they show up for one another every single day.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great to hear that from Stephanie, because that's, I think, our ambition, to be this inclusive and really diverse, not for the sake of diversity, but diverse for the sake of the ideas that are brought to the table. I'm so proud to sit on this executive team. I think we have a really interesting blend of perspectives, industry experience. You know, Katie comes from a very long and illustrious finance career. And I think, you know, there's a very diverse blend of what we bring to the table. I don't think every executive team has that real kind of fabric of their backgrounds that we're trying to knit together. And I think that it only works when you have a culture that's really inclusive, that wants to hear each other, that is truly open. I think it's interesting. I've worked in a lot of industries in the marketing capacity, so across fashion and beauty, some startups. And I think those are not always known as like the most inclusive tables, and perhaps not the most open. And I think that that's what's really interesting about restaurant is our basis in hospitality extends to our employees. So kind of assuming that positive intent and really trying to come to a conclusion together that's productive to the business. You know, I see that in our restaurants, and then at the executive team table, we may not always agree, but there's certainly that willingness to say, let's knit together our diverse experiences and find the right answer for the company. And I think that's very unique, just yes, in the industry, but maybe it is even unique as it comes to Shake Shack, just given our kind of hospitality roots and how we were founded.
Makes sense.
The thing that I would add to this too, it's an amazing, you know, discussion, probably one we could go on for much longer about. But, you know, if you think about Shake Shack as being a people first organization, and our teams are amazing, our teams in our shacks, our teams in our support centers, just really some of the truly best of the best individuals. And that unique role that finance has to play in growing opportunities and careers, you know, as we are building this company and see the opportunity to operate 1,500 shacks, many multiples of what we are today. It is just, you know, we think about this a lot, the careers, the paths that we're building for our people to continue to advance within the company. It really is powerful. And I know something that, you know, when I visit restaurants with Stephanie, or, you know, when I'm working with Steph and her team, you know, these are the future leaders of our company that we are providing opportunities for. It's a truly amazing feeling.
Does it take a certain amount of energy or drive to succeed in fields that are traditionally not used to seeing people like you?
I don't know if it takes those things as much as it just takes the courage to speak up, the courage to share your beliefs or the opportunities. You know, I've had a few incredible leaders that I have learned from in my life, and they have. The three that stick out the most are all male. And I think that they instilled in me, it's less about gender and more about creating value for the organization and having the courage to speak up at the table when you have ideas and share the opportunities to create value for the company. I think most organizations see past gender very quickly when they see individuals that can deliver value to the organization. So I probably lean the furthest away from focusing in on, you know, gender specifically, and more just on the value creation for a company. And I think that to the degree women are willing to voice their opinions and bring new ideas to the table, in most organizations, and certainly in the right organizations, those things are certainly held in pretty high regard. Katie, what would you add?
Yeah, I would say, you know, it pretty much, you know, spans up to confidence, having confidence in your work and your ideas, be willing to work hard to come to the, you know, the value add for the organization. I think the other very important thing, and this is something that, you know, has, you know, motivates me on a pretty regular basis, is representation matters. And I think that, you know, I see it all the time. The younger women, the more junior women within our company, they look up to us and they see that path forward. I know certainly when I was starting out on Wall Street, there were certain women that I really looked up to and identified with and sought out as mentors. And it's important to have, you know, all mentors, but I found it in my history and my story that the female mentors were particularly helpful.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with what both Katie and Stephanie said. I think that the one thing I would add is, you know, I personally, and I think a lot of women benefit from the fact that at a younger age and maybe earlier in my career, there were a lot of opportunities and a lot of eyes put on, let's make sure there are women in the room. So, for example, I'm really proud that 60% of our team members are women at Shake Shack. I think starting out and earlier in your career, before you can have that chance to say, I'm really confident that I bring, you know, and I can deliver and I, you know, have this proven track record of results. I think it's just very important that all industries really look at their feeder and look at how they begin. Who are the most junior people in the room? At that moment, it's not about whether or not someone has the skills, because maybe no one has the skills. And, you know, the whole point is to create the right environment and the right training environment so everyone can do their best. While that sounds very cheesy, I think that in my early career, I was in a lot of programs like an analyst program or a consultancy program or even a classroom that really prioritized ensuring that women had a seat at the table. And I think there are very few women in the world who would ever waste that seat. So to me, I think it's just about making sure that at more junior levels, there is a gender balance, that there is an opportunity given. And I see that really changing within a lot of industries, because it's proven that if you give her a seat at the beginning, she won't waste it. And later she'll probably do some amazing things with that seat.
This is something that I've told myself and I tell other people who, you know, are a little bit nervous to take that next step, is you got here for a reason. This is not surprise. We're not sitting here. This is not a lottery of we're just like handing out opportunities. We believe in you. Our success is vested in you succeeding. So we're all aligned and we're going to support the heck out of you. And, you know, as you're taking this risk, and we're going to give you the tools you need and we're going to be here for you. And I think that that really helps a lot. And I know when I feel that way that, okay, I'm taking a risk, I'm taking a next step, but I know people have a vested interest in my success and we are doing this together. It just helps.
Great. I would add, especially in the restaurants themselves today, while we have, you know, a really nice blend at the restaurant level of male and female, one of the places where I'm leaning a lot with our female leaders is our above restaurant leaders, our area directors, our regional directors. And what I have found is it may be a little bit less around imposter syndrome, a little bit more around the fear of the what ifs. And I would kind of just even think back to this last week in Chicago and talking to a couple of very strong female leaders, and they are absolutely ready to take the next step. And they're so focused on the what ifs of, you know, when you're an above restaurant leader, you're kind of on call 24/7, you know, that the hot water heater may go out, you may have a fire, you may like all of these potential what ifs. And what am I going to do? Because I'm also a mother and I've figured out how to manage being a general manager. But now if I'm going to oversee 5, 6, 7 restaurants, what does that look like? And trying to just instill in them that we're never going to know the what ifs. And there are going to be those days and it's going to be 9 o'clock at night and something's going to happen. And you may just put everyone in the car and go to the restaurant, take care of what you need to take care of and go home. Those things are going to happen 2, 3, 4 times a year. That's not a reason to not take the job. And I think just helping female leaders think through that work-life balance and what that looks like, and that conversation of that would be okay if I put my kids in the car and went to the restaurant at 9 o'clock at night. And, you know, my answer is yes, you know, I don't know who can get childcare at 9 o'clock at night. So yes, let's go. And I think getting them to walk away from all the what ifs and the fears and to make the leap and just having those real conversations with our team members is a big focus for me as we think about developing, you know, the next level of leaders. If we want to get to 1500 shacks over the next number of years, I need all of our leaders. I need all of our best leaders. And so removing some of that fear is a pretty big focus for me.
Yeah. I think the only thing I would add on imposter syndrome is, you know, a lot of imposter syndrome is why me, when you get to that seat at the table or you're trying to make that presentation or you're trying to convince someone of something in a work context. And maybe it's just my general attitude on life, but I've always said, well, why not me? And I try to do that with my team as well. And frankly, with my kids, well, why not you? Could have been anyone. There's so many factors within life. And I think when Katie says, you know, we're all behind you and the team is supporting you, I think my encouragement always in the moments where it feels like, why me, is to always flip it and say, well, this is an opportunity to say, why not me?
There's a reason Campbell's has been the soup authority for generations. And with Campbell's Culinary Reserve, they're also your low-fit passport to global flavors. With more than 60 chef-inspired varieties, Campbell's Culinary Reserve gives you scratch-made quality and on-trend flavors that scale with your operation. From standalone stars to versatile menu builders, discover how Campbell's Culinary Reserve can transform your menu at campbellsfoodservice.com.